It's Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Sun Prairie couple is traveling Route 66 from one coffee shop to another and turning the trip into a podcast. We'll talk with them about what they've discovered.
First, much of the focus of Wisconsin's fall elections is on the races for governor and for U.S. Senate, but there's also a competitive statewide race for attorney general.
Republican incumbent Brad Schimmel is seeking a second term as the state's top cop. His Democratic challenger, Josh Call, is a former federal prosecutor in Baltimore and the son of former state attorney general Peg Lautenschlager. He was also recently endorsed by former Vice President Joe Biden. Schimmel is backed by 63 of Wisconsin's 72 sheriffs, including 12 Democrats. There's also a Constitution Party candidate in the race named Terry Larson.
Since January, Schimmel and Call have raised about the same amount of money, though Schimmel has about $250,000 more cash on hand. Todd Richmond is a Madison-based reporter with the Associated Press, and he joins us now to talk more about the issues in this race. Todd, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So neither of these candidates had a primary challenger, and as a result, both campaigns have been kind of quiet so far. That's likely going to change. How contentious might this race shape up to be?
Well, I think it's going to get very contentious. Already today, the Schimmel campaign put out a statement calling Call inexperienced and that he's never prosecuted a criminal case in the state, and that he basically doesn't have an understanding of how the State Department of Justice works. So that's really their first pushback. Call has already been sort of piggybacking on attacks by One Wisconsin Now against Schimmel for Schimmel's trips to the conservative conference in California last year and a visit he made to Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago club last year as well. So you can see these battle lines are starting to form up right now.
And speaking of battle lines, we have what is going to be a very contentious race for governor in Wisconsin. We've got a U.S. Senate race that may also get ugly. But is this a race that, this attorney general race, is this one that is on the radar of your average Wisconsin voter?
Well, it's tough to say right now. We're looking to the Marquette poll on Wednesday to see if there's any kind of tracking of where things stand on the attorney general's race. But it has been playing out in the background right now. We had a high-profile U.S. Senate race between Kevin Nicholson and Leah Vukmir for the Republican nomination. And we had a multi-candidate field for the Democratic gubernatorial nomination. There's just not a lot of media oxygen left for Schimmel and Call. And there hasn't been because there's been no primary. So things are really going to ramp up here in the coming weeks.
Let's talk a little bit about the two candidates, starting with Attorney General Schimmel. What were some of the issues, and what was his focus during his first term as Attorney General?
Well, I think you saw that he was trying to make a point that he is indeed a staunch conservative Republican. He joined a number of multi-state lawsuits against former President Barack Obama's some of his policies, including health care reform, some of the environmental regulations. He's also successfully defended the GOP drawn legislative boundaries in Wisconsin all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and basically won there. So he's been playing the GOP ticket and doing everything that a GOP candidate you'd expect from a GOP attorney general.
And the state's top cop, I wouldn't necessarily think, is a really straightforward partisan position. But as you said, Schimmel is kind of touting his conservative views and his actions. Is politics just part of this position now, whether we like it or not?
Well, it is an elected partisan position. So those political leanings are going to filter down into how the attorney general chooses which policies to prioritize. Especially when you start getting into, you know, whether or not you want to take on the presidential administration. Some people are saying that Call could become another one in a picket fence of Democratic attorney generals that are pushing back against the Trump administration if Call were to get into office. So the partisan leanings are there. There's no way around that. And that's sort of what the office has been for years.
We are talking with Todd Richman of the Associated Press, and we're looking at Wisconsin's race for Attorney General. And let's turn now to his challenger, Josh Call. We talked a little bit about his background there in the intro, but tell us more about what we know about Josh Call.
Well, I think one of the most notable things about him is he's the son of former Democratic Attorney General Peg Lautenschlager. He graduated from Stanford Law School, spent some time on the East Coast working as an assistant federal prosecutor in Baltimore. He represented Hillary Clinton in the presidential recount in Wisconsin in 2016, and he also represented voters in a challenge against the Republican-drawn legislative boundaries. So he, like Schimmel, he's been taking on Democratic themes, just like Schimmel's taking on Republican themes. He's very polished. He's a quick thinker on his feet. So I think he makes a formidable candidate for Brad Schimmel, or a formidable challenger for Brad Schimmel.
And as you just mentioned, the son of Peg Lautenschlager, is that something that he's playing up, or is that something that he's kind of keeping in the background and not talking about so much?
I've not heard him say much about Peg at all. I mean, so it's not been a real issue that I've heard of, at least publicly.
And so I'm sure we're going to see ads in this race coming soon. We're going to see liberals attacking Schimmel. We're going to see conservatives attacking Call. And like it or not, I mean, is this going to be a referendum essentially on President Trump?
Well, it's tough to say how that will trickle down on the ticket. They are a down ticket. This is a down ticket race. As some Republican strategists say, I mean, it's hard to tell whether voter anger towards the president might drift that far down on the ballot, or if Schimmel might find himself caught up in a blue wave. It's a little difficult to tell right now. Hopefully the Marquette poll tomorrow will have some questions about the attorney general's race and give us a little bit of a beacon here to guide us as we go forward.
If I remember correctly, too, I believe Josh Call had said something about wanting to clarify the state's policy on abortion, especially considering, maybe Call is thinking that Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh would be confirmed. We might be in a position where Roe versus Wade is questioned. I believe Call said something along the lines of, hey, we need to revisit this. We need to work with the legislature to do that. And Schimmel saying, hey, that's not really the job of the attorney general. You're not making the policy, you're just kind of enforcing what's there. Is that something that you really think Schimmel is going to be pushing in the coming weeks?
I'm not really sure what you're getting at. Can you repeat that question, please?
I'm wondering if Attorney General Schimmel is really going to be pushing this narrative that, hey, the position of Attorney General isn't to make policy, it's just to enforce what is already there.
Well, that's been Schimmel's mantra since he got in, and both sides will try to brand the other as going beyond that and advancing their partisan stances and partisan themes. So with the abortion, I believe Call said he would have to study Wisconsin's actual ban before he has to decide whether to defend it in court. So he's sort of dodging that at this point.
As we said, we've got about 70-some days for voters to get to know these candidates. Do we have any debates set up between the two of them coming up?
Call has challenged Schimmel to 8 different debates, but I don't think the Attorney General has responded in either way if he'll accept it or not at this point.
And briefly, as we wrap up, what else are you going to be watching for as this race goes on, including the poll results and beyond that as well?
Well, I think we'll be watching to see if Josh Call continues to attack, or if he starts to define himself more by putting out an agenda for the Department of Justice. Right now, he's been sitting back and letting some liberal groups go after Schimmel and sort of chiming in on the back end of those attacks. But he may need to do more to let voters know what he wants to do. What is his agenda? And he's going to have to articulate that. in a stronger way than he has so far, I would think. So I'm looking for him to sort of come out with a stronger policy goals, clarify his platform, and we'll see if he goes that route.
Well, Todd, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Todd Richmond is a Madison-based reporter with the Associated Press. We talked with him about the latest developments in the race for Wisconsin Attorney General between the incumbent, Brad Schimmel, and Democrat Josh Call.
Right now, if you love coffee, or even if you don't, your local coffee shop can be a pretty special place. When done right, it's a spot where you can meet new and old friends and build community.
A Sun Prairie couple is using their retirement as an opportunity to visit some of the best coffee shops on Route 66 and make a podcast at the same time. During their travels, they talk with folks about their personal lives, politics, and of course, their favorite coffee.
Dan and Linda McGarry are the creators, producers, and hosts of the Cross Country Coffee Roadshow podcast. They're with us here in the studio. Dan and Linda, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you, Judith.
Dan, let's start with you. People do a lot of things during retirement, but traveling the country to make a podcast isn't usually one that's on the top of the list. What made you decide to take this on?
Long story, which I'll try to make short. About 7 or 8 years ago, a friend of mine said, while we were sitting having a coffee at one of the major chains, "Dan, I know you like coffee, but why do you like this coffee? This is burned." And I said, "Well, I don't really know." So I started exploring local coffee stores that had different kinds of coffee and independent roasters. And all of a sudden, I became more appreciative, not only of the coffee, but of the independent business owner. And so as we travel the country, we would stop someplace and then we'd say, "Well, how come more people don't know about this place?" And so we for the last probably 2 or 3 years, we've had this idea that when we retired, we would like to promote independent businesses and independent coffee stores and kind of put a spotlight on some of the best coffee places in the United States, and one coffee store at a time across America. So that this year it was Route 66.
That's awesome. Well, Linda, how did you decide that a podcast was the right medium to tell these stories, to tell about the coffee and the people and the businesses?
Well, when people travel, like we do, and our friends, we're always looking for good coffee shop. And because we want to highlight independent coffee shops, we thought, how can we let everybody else know that there's a whole world of coffee out there outside of the chains, which are fine, but there's a whole world of independent coffee stores. So that's what we decided to do.
And so how do you find the coffee shops? How, you know, you're traveling, you're getting, you know, one of the things about chains is you see it, you know exactly what it is, right? But you're going to new places. How do you find the coffee shops, Linda?
We started, we did Route 66 two times. We chose Route 66 as our first mission. In January, we set out in Chicago, and we just searched out coffee shops from Chicago to California. We found 24, and we had to kiss a lot of frogs because there were some coffee shops that we rejected based on a number of things. And we recruited all of them, and they were excited to have us come back and listen to stories.
So, Dan, you contact them before you get to a place. Is that how it works?
Well, what we did is we went incognito initially so that they weren't putting on any airs. It was just the place the way it was. And one of the neatest I think it's on the podcast. I don't think I edited this out, but one of the neatest interviews I had, one of the baristas said, "I am just so curious. How did you choose us? What made you choose us?" And I had to really kind of try to put that gestalt into a nutshell,
right,
and say, well, it's everything. You know, it's the way you're greeted when you walk in the door. It's the coffee. It's how much passion you put into your place and your job. It's a number of things. And so I was able to tell her. I was like, "Yep, that's how." And she said, "You mean out of all those stores, those 200 that you went, I was like, "You got it."
Wow. So you're getting in touch with the businesses, but a lot of the people you're talking to, besides the business owners or people working there, are customers, are community members. And Linda, how have you learned to get people to open up and to feel comfortable talking with these strangers passing through town with their recording equipment?
Well, we do have our recording equipment set up, but my job was to go out and recruit the people. We found that 80% of the time, because of our sound booth, they're curious and they want to be interviewed. Or the owners will say, oh, go pick this person, go pick that person. And on occasion, I'll have to go out. I introduce myself, tell them what we're doing. Would they like to share a story? And most of the time, they do.
We're talking with Dan and Linda McGarry. They're the creators, producers, and hosts of the Cross Country Coffee Roadshow podcast. They live in Sun Prairie, but travel across the country, visiting coffee shops and talking with people. And boy, do you two talk with people. You get amazing conversations. Let's give people a little flavor of it by listening to a bit of your chat with Neil Brennan, who you met at Little Ireland Coffee in Pacific, Missouri.
Tell me a little bit about your life. How long have you lived here in Pacific?
93 and a half years.
You have quite an interesting association with this building before it was a coffee store. Is that right?
When I was a teenager, I worked here for Tevis Furniture and Funeral Home.
And can you tell me a little bit about that business? It was actually a furniture store and a funeral home?
The part on the other side of the partition here where you come in was the furniture store. This wasn't a funeral home, it was a funeral parlor.
And what did you do in that stage of your life here?
Oh, I was a store clerk and I drove the ambulance and stuff like that.
I just have to say, when else would any of us get to talk to someone like Neil Brennan? Dan, that seemed like an amazing conversation that would have stuck with you.
I had a hard time editing that interview because Mr. Brennan, he wanted me to call him Neil, but I had a hard time calling him Neil. But he was just such an original character. And later in that interview, I mentioned that he is the original Batman. At one point, he was a U.S. Marshal, and he was the law in the town. And as part, they had no way to signal him for radio, so they would put a red light on the top of his house. And if he could see it from the cliffs, he'd know that there was trouble, and he'd have
wow.
to come.
So the bat signal got sent up.
The bat signal. And unfortunately, I said, so, Neil, you were the original Batman. And he was like, sure. he really didn't have a response. I don't think he quite got that, but we were fortunate in that we did not schedule any interviews. We simply walked in and we met real Americans, real people telling real stories, which we didn't think there was enough of.
Hmm. Linda, what are some of the conversations that really stand out to you?
Oh my gosh. Well, as I said, we have laughed and cried our way across Route 66. The amount of people suffering from mental illness is astounding, from depression to opioid addictions. That was a big shocker to me. Mm. And they were brutally honest. And it was uplifting because they had a story to tell that they want people to know that you can get better. And that was an eye-opener for me.
Wow. And I have to say, those are tough topics to talk about, and yet, again, here you are rolling into town, setting up your sound booth, and people are, it sounds like, bearing their souls to you. What do you think it is about this this setup, Linda, that encourages that?
Well, our sound equipment, it's inclusive. I mean, there's nobody that can see them. And we start off with, everybody has a story to tell. Do you have a story that you want to share that needs to be told? Everybody has a story to tell.
And Dan, it sounds like sometimes, you know, you start a conversation, but you have no idea where it's going to go. How do you stay kind of in the moment with these people? And, you know, they might say something really surprising, something either very difficult, like, you know, you were talking about mental health issues, or something really moving, or, you know, how do you just kind of go with the flow?
I was blessed. I was in family medicine for a number of years and as a PA, and so I learned to interview people at that mm-hmm. point as far as doing histories. But I found that basically just being honest with people, telling them what we were doing and why we were doing it, it allowed people a window. They always had wanted to say this particular story, and it gave them a platform. And that's what we wanted. We just wanted them to have a platform. And Linda was not exaggerating. We've laughed and cried across the United States. And when somebody has said to us, my gosh, I didn't think I was going to tell that story to you, we know we've done what we needed.
Before we run out of time, I want to listen to a little clip of people talking about politics. You have a section called Percolating Politics, and this is an example.
And people would say, well, are you Republican or Democrat? I'm neither. I just want to have neither. Why can't I have that middle ground? It's like, because people say, well, Republicans are this, so Democrats are that. I don't care. If you get three people in the room, they're all going to disagree.
And this whole left-right divide, which I never could stand. It's like, oh, the left says this, the right says this. It's kind of like, why has it got to be one or the other? Why can't, there's a ton of gray in America, in this country, that kind of gets left on, like, we don't really have advocates for the gray areas, or the purples, I'll put it that way, because it's always red, blue.
You two are really bringing people together. Are there plans underway for another season?
Ideally, yes, we are looking, hopefully, if things go well, we will be trying to do Highway 101 next year in California, going up the coast.
Great. And briefly, Linda, where can people listen to the podcast?
CrossCountryCoffeeRoadshow.com.
Which is a great name, I have to say. Dan and Linda, thank you so much for joining us. I got to listen to some. I'm going to listen to the rest as soon as I can.
Oh, please do. Thank you so much for having us.
Dan and Linda McGarry are the creators, producers, and hosts of the Cross Country Coffee Roadshow podcast. First, if you're heading to happy hour after work today, you're probably not thinking about it as part of a long, long tradition that dates back to human beings' earliest ancestors.
But it turns out you are. From early civilizations in Sumeria and ancient Egypt to saloons in the Wild West, our next guest says as long as people have been around, they've been getting drunk. Mark Forsyth is a writer and author of the book A Short History of Drunkenness: How, Why, Where, and When Humankind Has Gotten Merry from the Stone Age to the Present. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So first off, great topic. Second, why was this a topic that you wanted to explore?
I've always been interested in, back in my early 20s, I was sitting in a pub with a bunch of people, we were all getting drunk, and I thought, why are we doing this? And in some sense, it didn't. Some people have that thought, and they stopped drinking forever, whereas I didn't stop drinking at all. I just became curious. As if an alien came down from outer space and said, what are you up to? How would I explain it? What's actually going on? What are the rules? Why are we doing this on a Friday night rather than on Tuesday morning? Why are we doing it in this place and not that place? And what is this thing, which I very much enjoy, but what is it?
And you say this isn't a book about alcohol per se. It's about drunkenness. Why is that an important distinction here?
Well, there's an awful lot of books about fine wines, fine whiskies, all that sort of thing, about how alcohol is made, whereas I was much more interested in about the effect that alcohol has on you. And it's always the same active ingredient, whatever it is you're drinking, whether it's beer or whiskey or the most expensive wine available from the champagne fields of France, or just some moonshine from a still in the backwoods. It's always the same ingredient, but we react to it differently. And in different times, in different places in history, we've done different things. We thought it produced different effects. Because one of the very odd things about alcohol is it will do to you what you think it will do to you. This is something which can be scientifically tested. If you come from a culture that tells you that alcohol will make you violent, then when you drink, you'll become violent. Whereas if you come from a culture that says alcohol will make you see visions of the ancestral spirits, then you will see visions of the ancestral spirits. And it's a beautiful, it's a drug that gives back to you exactly what you expected to find. But the rules keep changing, and they've changed, and everyone has got drunk in different ways and at different times. If you were getting drunk in ancient China, for example, you'd be waiting to see the ancestral spirits. That's why you got drunk. You got drunk until you saw granddad grinning at you. If I got so drunk that I saw my grandfather grinning at me, that's the point I'd call it a day.
That's when we cut you off.
yeah, absolutely, yes. Granddad, leave the room.
So you start to go back in time, and you go back, and you start to think, well, where did this really start? Where did we start to, you know, hit the bottle in history? And you kind of find out that it starts with evolution, and you say that we really kind of evolved to drink and to kind of get drunk. How did this happen?
Well, all of the higher apes, and an awful lot of, it's just they can't produce alcohol. But alcohol occurs naturally. You just leave fruit to go off and it starts becoming alcoholic. And some places fruit becomes very alcoholic very quickly. There's an island off Costa Rica, which I've always wanted to visit, but I never actually have, where there's a particular fruit which goes very alcoholic, and the that live there like to just eat this fruit at a rate which approximates to, if you're going to do a human equivalent, of about a couple of bottles of wine an hour. And they just lie around in the forest canopy absolutely drunk, and occasionally they fall out and hit the ground, and I'm afraid they die. Elephants like to get drunk as well. But we have one particular mutation which makes us the second best drinker in the entire animal kingdom by body weight. And that mutation seems to have occurred about 10 million years ago, about the same time that we came down from the trees. And a very plausible theory is that we came down from the trees because we wanted to get at the lovely ripe fruit on the forest floor, which was a little bit alcoholic. Humans have an incredibly developed nose for sniffing out alcohol. We're like, in the same way that great white sharks can sniff blood from miles away, we are really good at sniffing alcohol from a distance. We find the fruit on the forest floor. It's a little bit decayed. It's a little bit overripe. It's got the alcohol in it. We start eating it. We love it. And then there are other evolutionary little funny things that go on in our brain. For example, it would be a good idea if we then just stuffed ourselves and made some fat deposits. And that's why when people have a lot to drink, they start getting really hungry. A starvation response for some reason kicks off in your brain, probably to make you eat all of this overripe fruit which you found on the forest floor, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and I like that you write about in the book about sort of what you were talking about there, this, I believe you call it the drunken monkey hypothesis, your words, not mine.
They're not even my words. The drunken monkey hypothesis, as funny, as comical as that sounds as a title for a scientific theory, is a proper scientific theory.
Okay, so let's not sell that short then. That's a proper scientific theory. But what's interesting, too, is you kind of find out that this sort of helps explain why we're kind of a social species, why, in a way, alcohol kind of brought us together and we bring it out kind of at social gatherings. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, well, the evolutionary theory is that the thing about alcohol is it's very nutritious. About 10% of all the enzymes in your liver are actually designed just to turn alcohol into energy. It's a great thing, but obviously it leaves you a little bit helpless. And so the evolutionary theory of why we drink socially and together is that we are that can therefore protect each other when we're drunk. And that therefore, if the saber-toothed tiger Tyrannosaurus rexes didn't exist at the time, but a saber-toothed tiger came through the forest and found one drunk guy passed out, they'd eat him. But if they find 20 drunk humans, then they're going to just back off and leave us be. And that's why, at base, we really like as a species to drink in groups. When you meet your buddies at the bar, they have got your back and have always had your back for millions of years.
Which is a great thing to tell your friends when you're at the bar drinking with them.
Absolutely.
We are talking with Mark Forsyth right now. He is the author of A Short History of Drunkenness. And let's fast forward a couple thousand of years and head around the world to learn a little bit more about our history with alcohol, about humans drinking alcohol. And I want to talk about Turkey. You talk in the book about the oldest known building in the world and its purpose being a little bit of a mystery, but there's a good chance that it had to do with beer. Tell us more about that.
So there's Göbekli Tepe, which is 5000 BC, oldest building in the world. It must have required a huge number of people to get together to build it, and an awful lot of organization. But the weird thing is, this is pre-agriculture. This is when humans were still small tribes, hunter-gatherers, running around chasing people, animals and hunting them. And how, therefore, did they get together to build a massive temple complex? And it's also in a place, this great big temple complex, in a place which is no good for agriculture. There's no real signs of agriculture, except there are some little trace elements you can find. They were found by a guy called Patrick McGovern, University of Pennsylvania. Little trace elements in the stone jars there of beer at the bottom of these stone jars. So the best theory as to why this first great building was built was that people were getting together to make beer, because to make beer you have to stick in one place just briefly, and then you can all get together and you can get drunk together as a large group. And it's a perfect place to get drunk. It's a lovely big hill in Turkey with a view over the plains where everybody would have hunted. But it seems that all the tribes from all around would come up onto this big hill. They would cooperate to make beer, and they would cooperate to build this great big temple.
And it seems like, you know, you write about there's almost like a chicken and an egg scenario where what came first, the beer or the agriculture? I would have thought maybe it's agriculture, and then while you're waiting for stuff to grow, the beer was kind of a side thing. But you say that maybe the beer was sort of the push in the direction of agriculture, and that was what came first.
There's a bunch of arguments for that. Yeah, that we settled. Basically, when you stop being a hunter-gatherer and you start being agriculture-based society, you stop getting beet, but you start getting lots of corn. But if you just have lots of corn and it's in the form of bread, then you don't have any vitamin B. And if you don't have any vitamin B, and vitamin B you can get from meat and you can get it from beer, but if you get it just from bread, you can't get it from bread. So if you try getting it from bread, you will die. Man cannot live on bread alone, quite literally, because bread doesn't contain vitamin B. So we must have, therefore, gone for the beer, and the beer maintains vitamin B. And in fact, beer is more nutritious. If you've got a bunch of barley and you want to get the most amount of calories out of it, most amount of nutrition possible, do not make bread, make beer. Beer is more nutritious, because essentially fermentation is kind of outsourcing the digestion process. So it's liquid bread, but it's better than bread, and it contains vitamin B. There are other reasons, and I don't know if you'd want to know them at this time in the afternoon, but there are other reasons involving the fact that beer sterilizes things, and if you settle down in one place, then you are essentially eating and getting water in the same place that you are defecating, to put it as delicately as possible. And if you're just drinking the water, then you are going to get very ill very quickly. So you can't have been drinking the water. That's the thing about agriculture, it makes you settle in one place. So again, you'd have to have got the beer before the bread.
Well, that's a great place to take a break right there. We are talking with Mark Forsyth, author of A Short History of Drunkenness, about the history of getting drunk.
And we want to hear your thoughts at 800-642-1234. When you've traveled to a new country, what have you observed about other cultures' relationship with alcohol? Are you surprised to hear about the sacred place alcohol held in certain cultures? What questions do you have about how people have gotten drunk throughout history? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Chris Molina. Right now we're picking up our conversation with Mark Forsyth, author of A Short History of Drunkenness, about how and why humans have gotten drunk throughout history.
We want to take your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about the role of alcohol in early civilizations? What do you think about the way our relationship to alcohol has changed over time? And if you've ever experienced a new culture, what did you think about their drinking traditions? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
And Mark, you alluded to this earlier in the interview, but you said that, you know, culture kind of defines how we experience alcohol. So if culture is saying, yes, alcohol is holy, drink alcohol, people are going to do that because they're going to think it is going to give them faith. And this has happened throughout history, including in ancient Sumeria, where Sumerians looked at beer as holy and sacred. Could you talk more about their relationship to beer in that country?
Well, they had a beer goddess, Ninkasi, but in fact, Sumeria would have been, if you went back to 2000 BC, 4,000 years ago, to, say, ancient Uruk, it would actually have been quite familiar to us in a way which is odd, given the whole history of drunkenness, because they had a goddess of beer. They had bars, which we would have recognized, the usual kind of places. They were little microbrewery bars, essentially. And a lot of it seems quite familiar. When you go into the history, they would sit and sing songs, drink beer. You ordered a big cauldron of beer and a bunch of straws, and everyone, because the beer had an awful lot of sediment, which are all stuff which floated to the top, so you put a straw in to get beneath the solid stuff and suck out the beer. So you drink that with your pals, and you would sing songs, you'd tell jokes. It was all pretty familiar and rather tame, and it was probably in all of human history, 4,000 years ago, is where we would have felt most at home, as opposed to, say, ancient Egypt, where everything was very odd in the religious drinking front, and they would get utterly, utterly drunk until they saw a vision of the goddess Hathor, and it was all engineered to mess with their heads in the most unpleasant possible way. And you were required to drink until you vomited, and then drink more until you vomited. But Sumeria was kind of happy drinking culture. They were just pleased with themselves. They had lots of kinds of beer, and they had drinking competitions, and they told jokes. In fact, I found the earliest example of an animal walks into a bar joke is from ancient Sumeria. There's a we all know those jokes about, you know, horse
sure.
walks into a bar. And why the long face. And though the punchline of the joke is lost, you can tell that it's an animal walks into a bar joke. And the joke goes, a dog walks into a bar and says, I can't see anything, I'll have another one. And I don't know what that punchline means, but I know it's a punchline.
Well, so you said that, in ancient Sumeria, it was more like what we're accustomed to now. Ancient Egypt was a little bit more recent. It was a little bit more extreme. Did you find that throughout history we kind of go in these waves where maybe it's a little bit more moderate, and then if you jump ahead in history to a different place, it's a little bit more extreme?
Yeah, things can go utterly crazy, and they can go utterly crazy very, very fast in ways that you'd find frightening. I mean, a terrible little blip in drinking history was what thing called the London gin craze, which essentially we didn't have spirits in effect until about 1600, 1700. There were no spirits. Everyone was just drinking beer or wine. Everything was therefore just low strength, and everyone thought they knew how to deal with it. You had a pint or a half pint of, you know, a large glass of this thing, and then spirits come along, and you've got gin, and you've got whiskey, and you've got all these things, and people just ordered them in the same amounts, these strange exotic new drinks, but they'd always drunk because you'd drunk a pint of beer, so now I'll have a pint of this new thing called gin, and people just dropped down dead, and alcoholism took off. And I mean, it didn't help that gin was flavored with all sorts of crazy stuff like sulfuric acid, and you should never flavor your drinks with sulfuric acid. It doesn't help with the digestion. Things change very quickly. And also, I mean, just the Wild West Saloon was a pretty frightening place. And that's really relatively recent, and your own country. But, I mean, America was the reason that Prohibition came in was that the USA did have, in the late 19th century, a big alcohol problem.
We are talking right now with Mark Forsyth. He is the author of A Short History of Drunkenness, How, Why, Where, and When Humankind Has Gotten Merry from the Stone Age to the Present. And I want to talk more about America, but before we do, I want to go to the phones, and Richard is calling in from Madison. Richard, hi, go ahead.
Hi, yeah. We've been talking a lot about drinking in groups and how this is sort of like a religious or holy sacred experience, but I'm wondering if your guests have found anything about what society thinks about the lone drinker in reference to all of this holy, sacred experience.
All right, Richard, thanks for that call. Mark, what do you think?
The lone drinker is very hard for a historian because, generally speaking, lone drinkers don't write much about themselves. You can't work out what it is they've been doing. And obviously, if they get drunk in there, and they're probably too drunk to write themselves. So it becomes There's very little in my book, I'm afraid, about the lone drinker, because he's a kind of undocumented guy. There's no particular reason that he shouldn't be having religious experiences or non-religious experiences or any other kind of experience. But I'm afraid he's a little bit off my track, because there's a problem with the history of alcohol, which is you not only have to have people getting drunk, but you have to have other people writing it down. And a lot of the time, in a lot of cultures, the sources are great. A Viking feast, how it began, everybody knows. How it ended, nobody's that certain.
Mark, we've got a few minutes left, and I'm curious, a lot of the behavior that you describe in the book and that we've talked about here today would be behaviors that I think today we look at as dangerous and we would label as alcoholism. And you used that word a little bit earlier in the interview, and I'm curious, at what point in history do we start to see that acknowledged as maybe a serious health threat?
So a funny thing about alcoholism is that it's very, very hard to define. Ask any psychiatrist for a definition of alcoholism, and if they're a responsible psychiatrist, they'll say, we don't know, we don't have a precise one. It's when your drinking becomes a problem, but exactly how that works is a difficult thing to say. Now, there always have been alcoholics, people who drink outside the rules, people who make their drunkenness a problem. People are drunk when they shouldn't be. People who are drunk when society expects them to be sober. But that's a permanent thing of history. The question is, though, when does society expect you to be sober? And that changes all the time. When does society expect you to be drunk? And that also changes all the time. So it's a very hard thing to say. I mean, a classic thing in this, just to go with big picture, is, for example, there are things which, it's anthropological terminology, wet cultures and dry cultures. In a wet culture, you drink a little bit all the time. If you've ever been to Italy and hung around in a bar, you'll know what this is like. People have a drink at halfway through the morning, a little drink with lunch. They never get drunk, but there's always a little drink being had all the way through the day. A dry culture isn't actually dry in our sense. A dry culture is a culture where you don't drink Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, but Friday night, damn, you go for it and absolutely get completely drunk. Now, if you live in a dry culture like that, which says it's fine to get very drunk on Friday night, and you get very drunk on Friday night, but then you stay sober Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, then you're fitting in with everyone else in your culture, and you are being fine, and the stuff you do on a Friday night is, well, you know, the stuff you do on a Friday night in your culture. As long as you're fitting in and not killing your liver, then you're all right.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us today. We are going to have to leave it there. Mark Forsythe is the author of A Short History of Drunkenness, How, Why, Where, and When Humankind Has Gotten Merry from the Stone Age to the Present. And you can chime in with more of your thoughts and your questions over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or tweet us if you've gone to a different country and you've seen their behaviors, their attitudes towards alcohol being different than our own. Let us know. Tweet us at Central Time WPR, or post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We've got an interview coming up on Thursday with a woman who decided to run 30 marathons before her 30th birthday.
First of all, that's amazing and got us thinking, what other goals do people set to achieve by a certain age? Maybe it has to do with travel or reading or learning to do something.
And what is it about those milestone birthdays that make us think about accomplishing things?
We want to hear from you on the Ideas Network comment line at 833-42-IDEAS. Have you ever set a goal for yourself to reach by a certain age? What was the goal and the age? And did you succeed? And what did you learn from the experience?
Give us a call before
or Thursday at 833-42-IDEAS. That's 833-424-3327. And we may just use your comments on the air.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then we'll hear about why Wisconsin is seeing a big rise in hepatitis C cases. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.